Cloudy and cool, patchy fog, 90% chance of afternoon rain, high of 43. Right now, 40 degrees Racine, 39 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm honored to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Penny Farmer, the author of a book called Dead in the Water, My 40-Year Search for My Brother's Killer. Penny Farmer is the sister of Chris Farmer, who was a brilliantly gifted young man who was destined almost certainly for great things, but then met with a truly ghastly fate. When he and his girlfriend, Peeta, were murdered, in fact, tortured and murdered. And as the subtitle of the book suggests, those who loved Christopher and mourned his fate worked tirelessly over the course of decades to try to solve the mystery of who had done such a terrible thing to Chris and Peeta. It is not often that such a search is ultimately successful, but it was in the case of the Farmer family. And even when such a search for justice is successful, we're not always told the story of that tireless search in such meticulous and illuminating fashion. But that is the case with this remarkable book, which is published by Diversion. Penny Farmer graduated with a degree in English literature and is now a freelance journalist and has done a marvelous job of telling this important, if ultimately tragic, story. Again, the book is titled Dead in the Water, My 40-Year Search for My Brother's Killer. Penny Farmer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for that lovely introduction. Thank you.
I wonder, ahead of us talking about the experience of writing this book, if you could just say a word about what it is like to talk about this book, which means, of course, talking about this story, talking about your brother, whom you loved very much, but also talking, of course, about the horrific end to his life. What has this experience been like for you?
To be honest, it's been very cathartic writing the book. I've had some very dark days when we actually discovered what exactly had happened on that boat. It was pretty horrific finding out the exact details from the skipper who committed the murders. We spoke in great detail to the younger son, and you know, he didn't spare us any details, but it was exactly what my mother and I wanted to know. We needed to know in order to get closure exactly what had happened. You know, we had imagined for 4 decades we were in the dark as to what had happened. So it was very important. I think when you lose somebody, you either go one way where you sort of batten down the hatches and you don't want to know anything, or you want to know absolutely every detail. And certainly my family and I were very much the latter. And yeah, we wanted to know everything really that had happened in order to come to terms with it.
Sometimes what we hear
in terms of writing.
Sorry. I just wanted to ask. Sometimes within a family, there will not be unanimity on such an important question as that. There will be some that want to know everything, and others for whom, if possible, they would choose a very different path. But it sounds like this was one thing in which all of you were very much on the same page, very much of the same mind. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I mean, there's my older brother, Chris, my brother who died, came between my older brother and I. But we were very much of the belief that it's because my father had died in 2013 without ever knowing what had happened to Chris, despite, you know, doing so much in the investigation in the 1970s and early 80s. Sadly, he died without knowing why it had happened. But my older brother and I took the view that it was very much down to my mother as to how much detail we should know. And, you know, she's incredibly stoical, my mum. And when the police initially told us what the boys, the skipper's sons had told the police, my mother wanted to know everything. And it was, I mean, our jaws were on the floor when we heard it. You know, for so many years we had lived sort of in our imaginations wondering how on earth they had ended up tortured and murdered in this inexplicable state. And the reality when we actually got to hear it was just far worse than we had ever dreamt of.
Before we talk about the tragic end of your brother's life and that of his girlfriend, Peta Frampton, let's talk about life with your brother Chris before all of this happened. Tell our listeners a little bit about what he was like growing up as a child, as a young man, and what he was like to you as a brother.
Right. He was super intelligent, but not an academic bore. He was very attractive, very, very much outgoing, very party animal, had so many friends. I mean, it's just unbelievable how many people have come forward. Even just last night, somebody on Twitter said, my goodness, my mum, because there's now a podcast being made of this as well, and she was listening to the podcast, and she said, you know, she always wondered what had happened to Chris and Peta, and just thought that they had disappeared in Central America. She never knew the full story. And you know, somebody just came forward last night to say my mum knew them. And, you know, so many people have said, you know, how lovely, what decent people they were. My brother always, you know, supported the underdog, always saw the best in people. They were just two really decent young adults, you know, with very worthwhile careers ahead of them. Peta, his girlfriend, was a lawyer. And as I say, my brother was a junior doctor. That they would have had very worthwhile careers ahead of them. Yeah, so it's a huge loss both to us and friends and really, you know, to the world, because they would have been worthwhile human beings. And when you see how senseless their murders were and so tragic, it's just so sad, you know, just terrible that somebody like Silas Duane Boston, a total psychopath, can just snuff out life like that.
Right, and snuff out all of the good that they would have done. But you're right, they had already managed, even in their short lives, to do a lot of good. Tell our listeners what you and your family found when you went through Chris's clothes and personal belongings that he had left behind back home. You found some gifts that he had kept,
yes.
and you make a point of saying what these say about him and how he was regarded.
Yes, well, I mean, some of his patients had given him gifts, like, for instance, a fountain pen with an engraving on, you know, one of his patients had given him, saying how grateful they were. And he was like that, you know. He was a truly dedicated doctor. He never stuck to hours. He just jumped on his motorbike and went into hospital if one of his patients needed, to be seen. He did it regardless of whether he was meant to be working or not. They were just great people. I mean, ironically, because when they went traveling after they'd finished their studies, Chris used to send home tape recordings in those days, you know, cassette recordings, and Peter wrote long letters home, his girlfriend wrote long letters. And that was really how we happened to know where exactly they were. You know, we could virtually pinpoint where they had, run into trouble through the tapes and through the letters. You know, we could geographically pinpoint where they were at any one time. But ironically, in the last tape home that Chris sent, you know, he had said, you know, please use my books, please use, the kitchen mixer, the food mixer that he'd left behind, etc. I mean, it was almost as if, you know, he'd had some premonition that something was going to happen and he wasn't going to come home. And it's just so ironic, his words.
Mm. We're speaking with Penny Farmer, and we're talking about her book, Dead in the Water, My 40-Year Search for My Brother's Killer. We're talking about her brother Chris, and Chris's girlfriend, Peta Frampton, and the mystery for many years that surrounded their tragic death. They were the victim of savage murders. Explain to our listeners the kind of trip that Chris and Peta were on at the time, a trip which, as you were just telling us, they, in a sense, very meticulously chronicled for you and anyone else who was listening with these tape recordings and letters and so on. What had set them off on this long journey in the first place, and how planned a journey was it at the outset?
It was very planned. Chris got a medical job over in Australia where they worked for 6 months, and then they, because they'd worked, you know, that their law and medical studies had kept them busy for a good 5 years, they had always had this plan to travel the world for a year, and they said that they would be home in a year's time, in time for Christmas in 1979. But they, after Australia, they flew to Los Angeles, and then they traveled down through Mexico, and where they had, because Chris was a great sailor, as a family we'd always sailed, we had a boat, and Chris wanted to get some sailing experience in, and they were great snorkelers and divers, and the Belizean coast, of course, has this beautiful Barrier Reef, which is only second, really, to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. So they wanted to get this experience in, and it was in Belize that they met the skipper of the boat, and they wanted to crew for him, and he used this boat to take tourists out to the keys and islands off Belize, and that's how they came to meet him in a little bar off the Belizean coast called Key Corker.
So explain what you know. I guess what I'm really asking is explain what you knew 40 years ago in terms of what happened to Chris and Peta.
Okay, well, they were missing, you know, to cut a quite complicated story short, they were missing for 10 months, and the my parents did so much investigation, as much as you possibly could. They virtually scoured the whole of Central America in terms of the embassies, and they even hired a private detective to go to all the tourist haunts, etc.
So, in other words, the tape recordings stopped, the letters stopped. They just suddenly you heard nothing more from them.
Absolutely.
And of course that was
where we had been hearing from them. Either one of them would have been in contact once a week, you know, by letter or tapes, or by phone. We heard nothing, and so obviously our anxieties grew, and my parents, as I say, started this investigation and then put it in the hands of the police. But the police in Manchester, where we lived, didn't really know how to handle it, because, you know, Central America was so remote. You know, we're talking back in the late 1970s, it was all very long-distance phone calls. The police weren't allowed from Manchester, allowed to make phone calls to Central America. And the last we knew was that they had got onto this boat. We knew from one of Peter's letters that they were on this boat off the Belizean coast. And then the next thing we knew, about 10 months later, was that two bodies had been washed up off about 200 meters off the Guatemalan coast, which is just south of Belize. And the two bodies had showed obvious signs of being tortured. They were weighted down with motor engine parts and plastic bags put over their heads, and they had ropes. They were hogtied, and in a dreadful, dreadful state. And what we were later to find out from the private detective that we had hired was who had met a Catholic priest on one of his travels to see if anybody had heard of them, was that they had been buried back in July of the previous year. They had been found in July and buried unidentified. So we had their dental records flown out, and very sadly, they matched up, and they were buried in Puerto Barrios in Guatemala. We always suspected that the skipper of the boat was guilty, but we could never pin it on him. This was all 40 years ago. We could never pin it on him. And in fact, he was brought in for questioning. But the most telltale thing was that one of Peter's letters was posted 2 weeks after the post-mortem showed that they had died. So we were pretty sure that that he had needed some alibi, and that was, you know, that was why he posted the letter. But we could never really understand it, because we knew from the boat manifest of where the boat had last left, the port that the boat had last left, was that he had two sons on board the boat, ages 12 and 13. And what we could never understand was, you know, this was a very small boat, a 30-foot boat. How on earth could this happen out at sea with two young boys on board? And, you know, so many times, my parents said to the police, please, please interview these two boys. You know, he went on he was investigated. He ended up back in Sacramento not long after this, in 1978, and was pulled in for investigation by the police and by the British consul in San Francisco. But they just couldn't. They thought he, from his body language and everything, you know, what he was giving away, that he was most, you know, certainly guilty. But they could not, because, you know, there was no. It was all circumstantial. All the evidence, the engine parts, and the ropes and the bags and everything had been lost over time. And it was all just circumstantial. And then as soon as he had been interviewed by the police, he went on the run. Hmm.
Tell us what it was like for your family to try to live in this limbo of not being able to know exactly what happened, and to try to come to terms with what you describe as something inexplicable and devastating. I think any family would struggle mightily to bear such a burden. For you and your family, how did you attempt to cope with something so terrible?
It was very, very hard. My parents, as I say, that they're very much sort of they're very pragmatic people. Very British, stiff upper lip. We are a family who are not particularly given to public displays of grief, but we internalize it. But their method of coping was very much to throw themselves into the investigation, even as late as 2001, 2002. My parents were still emailing, you know, once the internet came on board, that they were emailing Sacramento Police Department to see if Boston, the boat skipper, had come back on the radar, because the last thing we knew was in the late 1980s was that he'd gone on the run, and that both his sons couldn't be found. Every time the police had tried to get near Boston, he disappeared over the Mexican border, and they could never find him. And then I think ultimately they had given up. But it was really hard. You know, I say in my book, you know, it was the wreckage that we had to come to live with and come to terms with, each of us, you know, and I think we all grieved in our own different individual ways. To be honest, I found it quite difficult to talk about with my parents. I think I just sort of locked it down, if you know what I mean, because it was just once you let the floodgates open, it's just impossible to stop. And I think, I just sort of tried to lock it away, really. But we've never, ever forgotten, Chris. And it was really, you know, the fact that we've never forgotten, you know, in 2015, when I was out on the dog walk with my now, she was 91 then, my mother, we were still talking about Chris and saying, you know, what a beautiful day it was. And you know, I wonder what Chris would look like now. And that's how this all came about, to be solved. The case came about because I was literally on this dog walk on this lovely day, and I suddenly had this sort of like bolt from the blue to think, well, why haven't I looked for them, for Boston, the skipper and his two sons, on the internet and on Facebook particularly? And it was that brought about the arrest of Boston, because I literally ran home, this sort of like light bulb moment, thinking, I've got to find him. And of course, it wasn't very long that weekend before I found him, and I found out all this information about him and his two sons, and they were living their parallel lives on the other side of the Atlantic. And it was then that I realized, my goodness, you know, for the first time, we knew where he was and the boys were. And on the Monday after that weekend, I went back to the police in Manchester and I said, you've got to open this case. We can now find them. They're here. They're on the internet. Please, please go and arrest him.
Hmm. It's fascinating to think that someone who was so successful in evading law enforcement for such a long time, in a sense, seems to have grown complacent or overconfident, or maybe in some ways was naive about the way the internet works, that he would not have more effectively guarded his tracks in this way. Or perhaps he had come to believe somehow that you and others who loved Chris had finally given up your relentless search for him.
Absolutely. But, you know, bearing in mind that this was 40 years ago, you would think that, you know, I guess he had every right to think that, you know, arrogantly, that he was invincible and that he was never going to be caught. I mean, when he was arrested in 2016, he was age 72. And, you know, I mean, when he committed the murders, he was, 37, I think 38. So you can absolutely justifiably understand why he thought he got away with it. But the most revealing thing was that when we discovered that, you know, when we found out that the boys were willing to stand against their father in court, and we found out that they had witnessed their murders, you know, at close quarters on the boat, they had witnessed them being murdered. What we found out at that point was that they had been going forward to tell law enforcement about their father, but nobody believed them. But it was at that point we found out exactly what had happened on the boat and how it had all been brought about, because my brother, the skipper, was a child abuser. And he had killed their mother 10 years before he killed my brother and his girlfriend. What had happened was my brother was defending the younger boy from being beaten. And it was after that the skipper said to his sons, I'm going to kill them. The following day, he asked my brother to pull up the anchor on the boat. And as he did so, he went up behind him, crept up behind him, and beat him to a virtual pulp with a long sort of truncheon baton, which he was using to kill fish with, and he fractured his skull and some other bones. And then thereafter, he tied both him and his girlfriend up, and over the course of 3 days, tortured them. He stabbed my brother in the chest. My brother was in a very bad way. The reason the skipper was down in Belize was because he was evading law enforcement in Sacramento for the rape of a minor. And he tied Peter up down below in the bottom of the boat. I think, you know, without going into too much graphic detail, I think one can surmise what probably happened down there. My brother was on the top deck, very, very badly injured. And she was held down in a very small little cabin, the bottom of the boat. And after 3 days, he went engine parts over around their limbs, hogtied them, put another engine around their necks and plastic bags over their heads, and then they were pushed into the sea, fully conscious. And that's how they died. They died from drowning.
Tell us about the connection you were ultimately able to make with his two sons, Russell and Vince, and the difference they made in all of this.
Well, I mean, we were very grateful that they came forward and we got to know the truth eventually. As I say, it was very horrific hearing exactly how they had spent their last days, hours. It was, you know, I mean, you wouldn't do that to an animal. You certainly wouldn't do it to an animal. I wouldn't. You know, it's just mind-boggling, the evil. I mean, he was the devil walking. But what happened after that, when we had discovered we were going forward for trial, he was arrested and we had a pre-trial date set. My mother and I were going over to give pre-trial evidence in Sacramento, and 2 weeks before we were due to fly over, I mean, he knew we were coming, he decided to effectively take himself out of the equation, and he asked the doctor to stop all liquids and foods and his medication, and he was on dialysis. So effectively, he committed suicide. And he died 2 weeks before we were due to come over to give evidence. So that was another blow to us, a massive blow. It was like his final sticking two fingers up at us, really. You know, he wasn't going to give us the justice that we at that point thought we were going to receive after 4 decades. Once we knew that we weren't going to go to trial, the younger son, Russell, wanted to talk to Mum and I. Vince didn't at that point. He didn't want to speak to us. But Mum and I were very keen to make contact and to speak to Russell, and so I went over to Laguna, to California, and I spent 2 days with him, and whereupon he was very honest and answered all my questions, and there was nothing that he said he wouldn't tell me. It was pretty awful, yeah. But it was the details that we wanted to hear. We wanted to know how Chris and Peter had spent their last days.
One of the most interesting things that Russell ultimately told you was that the murderer's parents were in some very direct ways complicit in these crimes.
Absolutely.
Just say a quick word about that. That is such an intriguing and troubling part of this story.
Absolutely. They were, I mean, they completely shielded the children, because Boston, the skipper, was very scared when he went back to Sacramento that the police were going to talk to the children. And the grandmother and grandfather, the grandfather was a criminal. He had done a number of crimes as well. That they were very complicit in moving the children around between them. They were divorced, but they moved the children around so that they couldn't be interviewed. And they actually knew that their son had killed the son's, the little boy's mother 10 years before. That it was a dirty family secret that they had kept to themselves and told the two sons of Boston that they must never tell anybody that their father would be arrested otherwise, and they mustn't tell them. And that they were totally guilty of hiding their son from law enforcement, and helped him enormously. And so, yes, I'm afraid that the blame starts with the father and the mother. Mm. You know, that the evil start was rooted at that level. And it was just history repeating itself with the son, really.
And, of course, it's so important for us to know that you saw Russell, one of the sons of the murderer, as a victim, maybe a victim in a different sort of way than all of you were victims who lost your beloved brother and his girlfriend. But he was a victim too. And even in the midst of your grief, it sounds like that was something that was really at the forefront of your thought.
Absolutely. I mean, the Russell and Vince, are, as you say, victims. They lost their mother when they were aged 2 and 3, and now, weirdly, that this sort of strand across the Atlantic Ocean connects us. We're both victims. That the sons and we as a family are connected by this thread, because we are all victims. We all belong to this club of Boston's victims. But yes, I mean, we understand that they too have suffered, and it was important to spend that time with Russell to share not only what had happened, but because there's a lot of commonality between us. Enormously sad. And he's told me, he's told the police, that his father admitted to killing 33 people in his. He died at the age of 76, but told his son that he'd killed 33 people. Bearing in mind he spent 50 years on the run from the time when he killed his he was married 7 times, and he killed the boy's mother, which was his third wife. And he killed her in 1968. So he was on the run for 50 years, if you take it from that. He was a very lucky criminal who evaded justice and was, incredibly, incredibly evil. He just took their mother out into the desert and said, because she wanted a divorce from him, as did all the other 7 wives of his. And he shot her point blank. In the back of the head. Hmm.
So a monstrous life, certainly. And it is an incredible testimony to your courage and relentless determination to bring him to justice that eventually occurred. And, of course, our listeners can read in your book the richly detailed account you give of what this search for justice was like for you and your family. I want to finish by asking you to explain the opening line of the book's acknowledgments. You write, "This book is written with the assistance of my remarkable mother." Spell out to our listeners the way in which your mother was instrumental in you being able to put this book together.
Well, she's now 94 years old. She was 92, 93 when I wrote the book. She's just incredible. She's an amazingly strong, stoical woman. She's got her memory is absolutely laser. It's so sharp. It's laser focused. She's incredible. She's physically very able still as well. I mean, I'm immensely proud of her. She still walks the dog every day. She still drives, and she's just an incredible woman, and I'm very, very lucky to have her live with me. But it was thanks to her, really, and her memories, and that I was able to write the book so clearly and bring Chris to life, hopefully, in a way that people could just understand how special he was to us. And I'm enormously proud of my mother.
By the way, there is an intriguing photograph in the book of you and your 24-year-old son, Charlie. I think Charlie was able to join you right before you met the Russell, the son of the murderer. And you mentioned kind of in passing that he was on a backpacking tour of Southeast Asia that he presumably maybe cut short. It occurs to me that that had to take, in a sense, enormous strength and courage on your part to, in a sense, allow your son out of your sight, or allow him to visit the world in this kind of way, knowing the terrible fate that had befallen your own brother. And yet it sounds like you were not going to let what happened to your brother change the way you lived your life, or the way you would allow your, for instance, your son Charlie to live his life, and for him to see and experience the world.
But believe me, I was very worried. But it's a very different world that we live in nowadays. And of course, you do have mobile phones. I mean, I'm not even sure that the crime that occurred with Chris and Peter could happen today. Although that said, you don't always get mobile signal out at sea. But I don't know. Mobile phones are a blessing, and in some ways they're not, because when you can't get hold of somebody, you then wonder why. But I do have to safeguard against protecting all my three children too much. But you know, I do believe, as my mother still believes, that you've got to give kids roots, but the wings to fly. And you know, hopefully I have done that. But I was immensely glad to meet my son at Los Angeles when I went over to visit Russell. Charlie was my driver, so he drove me down to Laguna, and then he and I drove to Sacramento, because the prosecution team very kindly gave me a presentation for my family, which was lovely. And so Charlie came with me, which was great. And I'm very lucky to have three children, but I would never lock them up and put, you know, wrap them in cotton wool. Everybody's got to experience the world and see it for themselves. And what happened to Chris and Peter was horrific, but one has to get it in perspective and realize that, you know, they met a total, you know, 100% psychopath. If they'd gone around the world 1,000 times, it would have been hard to have met anybody so evil as Silas Duane Boston. He was literally evil personified.
Well, thankfully, you were able to bring him to justice and to bring his monstrous life, in a sense, to an end. And this is one of those cases that we also appreciate, in which we hear a good that can come from something like Facebook, of course, a tool which so often can be misused, but in your case, proved to be an invaluable tool in bringing Mr. Boston at last to justice. The book is remarkable. It's again titled Dead in the Water, My 40-Year Search for My Brother's Killer, published by Diversion, the author Penny Farmer. Penny Farmer, thank you so much for being so brave and open in telling this story, and for telling it so very, very well, and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it.
Thank you.
Very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your show. Thank you.
And the time is 8:48, and now exactly 8:49. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. Part two of today's program is Out of the Archives, an interview originally recorded back in 2012. And it is certainly a thrilling honor to once again be able to speak with one of the most gifted novelists before the American public today, a best-selling author many times over, Jodi Picoult's latest novel is called Lone Wolf, and it is an absolute masterpiece. And so I'm thrilled at this opportunity to be able to speak with the author. Jodi Picoult, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you.
We last spoke about a very different novel, which involved graphic novels, the world of comic books and so on. And that's several books ago. This time we are talking about, as the title suggests, a book which has something to do with The Amazing Wolf, and drawing some fascinating parallels and distinctions between the way wolves function and the way human families sometimes function or dysfunction, if there is such such a verb. Tell us, first of all, what piqued your interest in the wolf and made you realize it would be fertile ground for a novel?
Well, actually, the novel did not begin with wolves. The novels began with a thought about end-of-life care and about facing the question about whether to terminate life support. It was about 10 years ago. I was on a plane going home to New Hampshire, and I was seated beside a man who is a neurologist at a local hospital where I live. And he was talking about all of the traumatic brain injury patients that he had seen and some of the really horrific end-of-life decisions that were made in the wake of those traumatic brain injuries. And I said to him, you know, I am not ready to write this book now, but one day I'm going to be, and I'm going to get in touch with you. So please remember my name. And 10 years later, I called him, and he said, I remember you. I've been following your career. You're doing great. And he was more than happy to help me out. And that really was the genesis of Lone Wolf. But I began to think about the character, Luke Warren, who on page one is in the car accident that causes this traumatic brain injury. And I began one morning to just think about wolves. Didn't really know why. But I began to wonder what would happen if I created a character who, instead of just watching wolves from afar to learn about them, actually insinuates himself into a wolf pack to learn from within. And I really thought I was creating someone completely unique, only to find out, of course, that there was a man who did this for real. And I contacted him. His name is Sean Ellis. He lives in Devon in the United Kingdom. And when he was in America for a while working with the Nez Perce Indians, he managed to insinuate himself into a wild pack in Canada, in the Rockies. And I talked to him at length. I met with him. I met with the wolves that he now has in captivity, some of them, in Devon in the United Kingdom. And what he taught me was that wolves really don't deserve the bad rap that they tend to get. They are actually extremely intelligent animals, not cold-blooded killers. And for them, nothing matters more than family. Everyone has a very prescribed, important role within the family dynamic. And if you can't make the choices and the decisions and the actions that you need to within your role, you need to be replaced. And that whole situation seemed to dovetail beautifully as a metaphor with the story I was trying to write.
And of course, what we have here is a family that has been really torn apart by a lot of different factors. And in a sense, you are drawing quite a stark contrast between this, what seems at least to largely be a fairly tidy and predictable sort of hierarchy in these wolf packs, in contrast to that, a family in which nobody seems to know exactly where they fit in or what role they play with the other.
Right. You know, the thing about a wolf pack is, as long as you're doing your job, you are definitely part of the pack and everyone will lay down their lives for you. If you're not, then you're going to be kicked out or replaced or edged out in some way. It's a little militaristic. It's also a little like a really tight family.
Right.
It functions very much like the mafia, actually.
And it was fascinating to learn at one point about how beyond the alpha wolf that we all know about, there are beta wolves and tester wolves and diffuser wolves. I mean, this is a very complex system that seems to work really well.
That's right. And, you know, and a lot of people have heard misinformation, too, about it. Most people assume that the big, tough, strong wolf, the first one you meet in a pack, must be the alpha. It's actually not. It's the beta wolf. The beta is the enforcer, the mafia thug, and the one who is going to come out first because he's the bravest. But he's protecting the alpha, who always hides behind because the alpha is the collective brains of the group and the one who makes all the decisions, all the choices, and is really thinking so many steps ahead of where you would imagine. An alpha can hear the change in a heartbeat of an animal or human from 6 to 7 feet away. Mm. And she catches food based on how much adrenaline is running through its system. She can actually pump up the adrenaline before they make a kill so that That way, when the pack feeds off the animal, they have adrenaline in their system, and that makes them look stronger to other packs in the area when they mark their territory by urinating around it.
Fascinating.
So all of these things are amazing.
Yeah. So the name of the novel is Lone Wolf, and at one point we hear in the voice of Luke Warren, the man who's been caught in this car crash and suffered this terrible injury, at one point is he is describing the lives of wolves. He says, imagine being all alone in the wild. You are another animal's potential prey, a rival pack's enemy. You know that most packs will be prowling between dusk and dawn. And so for a lone wolf, not with a pack, how do they respond to the call that they hear in the distance? This is a fascinating... Yes.
I was going to say a lone wolf is always looking for a pack. There's safety in numbers.
Right.
And even a pack of two is better than being a pack of one.
Right. And, of course, in stark contrast to this, or yet a better said, I suppose, in very neat parallel, is the story then of Luke Warren's son, who has, in a sense, left the family, left his father, is, in a sense, a lone wolf himself. And the circumstances of this accident suddenly thrust him back into the heart of this family.
That's right.
What an interesting parallel to draw. What was it like to explore that?
It was great. I learned so much about wolves, so much more than I ever thought I'd know about wolves. And I'm pretty sure anyone who reads the book will feel the same way.
Right.
And the interesting thing is, you know, we do tend to anthropomorphize their behavior, to assume the reason they're doing it is because of love or some kind of affection or, you know, something that we would experience. And that's not really why wolves do what they do. They do it because they depend on each other. It's
right.
Really, at the bottom basic level, it's a matter of instinct and survival. And at the end of the day, if you can look around you and count all the wolves in your pack and say, we're all still here, that's a good day.
Yeah.
It's really that simple.
What I find fascinating is that you write so authentically about the experience of the son who left home, wrote a brief little note, and then was gone. And Edward, in a sense, is a human lone wolf. And I assume this is something you yourself have never done or never completely experienced the way that Edward has experienced it in his life. And yet you write about it as though you know exactly what it would feel like.
Well, thank you for that. But, you know, I tend to write many male characters. I've never been a man either. So I think it's just a matter of having some empathy and being able to try on someone else's skin and voice for size.
Right, I suppose. And one of the things I appreciate is that you also do such an interesting job of peeling away the details of the backstory of this family and these various characters. Very, very slowly and very, very carefully. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about how an author makes those choices about what to reveal when in the course of a novel.
Actually, it's a very hard thing to talk about because it's something that comes with time and, you know, with technical expertise. One of the hardest decisions that I make every time I start a novel is how much do I reveal at the beginning. You do want to play it out. You want to spin it out so that there's a little bit of mystery and suspense. Sometimes it's easy because sometimes your character doesn't know anything and has to discover it along with the narrator, with the reader. But sometimes your narrator does know things and is holding back and is an unreliable narrator, and that becomes an even more challenging situation. That's certainly the case in this book. Both Kara and Edward, the two children of Luke Warren, who are siblings fighting over his life decisions, they both have a secret, and we don't find that out until much later in the book, and that drives in part why they are each so determined to either keep their father alive or perhaps to turn off life support. You can't separate out their own reasons from their decisions about their father's health care.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating, terrible dilemma in which they find themselves, having to make such crucial decisions about a man that neither of them feel like they fully know or have no way of knowing what his wishes would be. And it is, of course, a position many families find themselves in. One of many fascinating facets to your wonderful novel called Lone Wolf.
Right.
It's an Atria book, and the author, Jodi Picco. Jodi Picco, you've done it again. Congratulations on this wonderful book.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, Brian Gill from the theater department at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside joins us to talk about their production of Shakespeare's comedy Love's Labor's Lost, which opens this weekend. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show also comes